Oxford, and they're all contributors to the spring issue of Peace Research, spring 2023. Okay, so let's start with the land acknowledgement.
Hey, Sego Skanagoga, Ryan Ujits, Jethan Waradu, Gwisil Suha. Just wanted to acknowledge everybody here, the people that are here. The land acknowledgement is for the peoples who live in this particular area or have lived in this area. And the ones that, anyway, I consider to be inhabitants previous and today are part of treaty, I guess, not necessarily all are the Cree, the Soto, the Nakota people, also known as the Assiniboine people, the Métis, we have to consider the Cree, Soto, Métis, the Dakota, who came up here infrequently. One of the things, a lot of the acknowledgments that we're having, usually include people who haven't not lived here. And I think that's to accommodate, present day realities of people moving in, but not necessarily inhabited this area. University of Winnipeg is on the land some of these people. And interesting enough, just south, just 25 feet from the University of Winnipeg, was the main grounds where the Cree would leave to go on their bison hunts. So they would camp there and then head down the Assiniboine River, Nakota, same people, head down the Assiniboine River to St. Charles. Not St. Charles, sorry. They would head down towards what we call the passage. And the passage is where many of the bison would cross and also where the horses could cross because it was the most shallowest part of the Assiniboine River. So, it's very significant because when they returned, they'd also process all their meat in that area. And the Métis would follow them, later on as they evolved as a group. So I should say Charles would, but it's one of the most important places really. And there were two streams that came up that area. There was the from the Assiniboine, there was Colony Stream, and there was also something a stream called later Spence Stream. And those were the places where people would fish and get themselves ready to go on these bison hunts. So it's a very significant area that you wouldn't know it by today because the streams have all been blocked up and everything else. So it's just to say there's a lot of history in this area. I just want to say Nyawa Miigwech for your participation in this. And sorry if I'm a little tired and everything and getting just a few of the names just because I'm more tired and getting ready to go out and such. But regardless, these were the main participants in this area. Thank you.
All right. So that was Dr. Brian Rice, who teaches at the University of Winnipeg. So thanks very much. Let's see. Oh, and now let's hear from our Canadian Mennonite University Vice President, Jonathan Duick. Thank you for stopping by, Jonathan.
Thanks for inviting me, Anna, and very nice to see you all here today. Oh, can you all hear me? Yeah, great. We're in the midst of a conference here, so hosting some folks, and so I'm ducking in and out here, but I'm delighted to see you all, and I want to offer my strong affirmation and congratulations for Anna as editor and Frida for all the work that you've done, and the writers for the conversation that's come together in this issue. of the Peace Research Journal, which holds a very special place as the leading journal in peace and conflict studies in Canada, a unique voice on the continent. We're very proud to host it here, and we know that it only comes about through the labor of a whole lot of people. The people that are here, the people that read, the people that cite, the people that draw these things into further conversations and use them in further research, and the labor of the folks that have built this over time. I'm looking at you, Neil. When I say that, I think about the ways in which an issue like this one is a conversation that links us from all the places we are, even here at CMU at Shaftesbury, where we're in the middle of a conference and talking about peace, and over time, with the work and the durability of our words and our conversation together, that uniquely a journal and the Peace Research Journal can give. So welcome here. We're very proud to host Peace Research Journal here, and deeply appreciative of Anna's work and of the work of all the writers that are gathered here today. Congratulations on the new issue. I'm going to stick around for at least a little bit of this discussion, and know that I'll want to hear what happened in the conversation afterwards, even though I have some other responsibilities I'll have to duck out to. But I'm delighted to see you here today, and welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan. And now let's hear a few words from Dr. Lou Kreisberg, who is on the Peace Research Advisory Committee and is a very special advisor to me and to Neil Funk Unrau. We love you, Lou. Let's hear from you. Can't wait to hear from you.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to hearing more about this issue. Knowing about conflict resolution, conflict transformation, fighting constructively is particularly useful. I think many of us looking around at the really dreadful conflicts may feel despair, and despair is not the best way to be able to act and reduce that and have some hope. And I think the material that we've all been working on for many years does show us that there are reasons for things deteriorating when people have acted stupidly or willfully or selfishly, and there are other ways which can mitigate that, control that. So knowing what we know is really a life protector for us, I think. And I just read today that a Canadian general said that Canada was at war with China and Russia, and China and Russia are at war with Canada. That probably is not the best way of understanding what is going on, and a little, I would say, disturbing. And we see that happening. So we have some agency in acting, even in conflicts that are taking place in distant areas, and grief maybe is not completely to be avoided. But it can be countered, and I think what we know helps in doing that. That's all I want to say.
Absolutely. Thank you, Lou, for those words and for your decades of contribution in terms of both academic and practice towards peace building, especially in the Middle East. Yeah, it's a heavy time. It's a difficult time. Thank you. Well, so I'll just introduce the staff here and turn it over to Neil Funk Unruh, Dr. Neil Funk Unruh. So first of all, Dr. Eric Schellhammer, thank you so much for joining us. Our book review editor, Frida Tong, our fabulous editorial assistant. There's Maureen Epp, the copyright editor, Ken McKenzie, layout editor, Margit Ratzlaff, who is our proofreader, Lucas Redekop, who helps with the budget, and Paul Little, who helps with the website. And Neil, I just want to say thank you to you for helping out this summer and for inviting Rebecca to take part to lead this very special issue. So I'll turn it over to you. Thank you, Neil. Neil is the former editor of Peace Research and also retired professor of conflict resolution studies.
Thanks, Anna, for the invitation to invite our special guest editor. And also a special thank you to Lou for his comments. I always appreciate getting a chance to hear from you again after all these years. But just to say a few words about Dr. Oxford as a distinguished scholar and educator in the interlocking fields of language, education, and peace, which interesting blend. And when I looked through the information that there's her resume, I was intrigued by the background that she brings to this whole field. She got her Bachelor of Arts degree in Russian with a minor in history and English from Vanderbilt University. From there on to Yale for a Master of Arts degree in Russian language, and then to Boston University for a second master's degree in educational psychology. And after that, a PhD from North Carolina in educational psychology. So she brings a really rich and diverse field to this whole background, to this whole topic. And after that, she has a number of awards. I won't go into all the details of all the different awards she has received, but has also published extensively. Her books were published in two overlapping waves. In the first wave, language education was dominant and peace was present as a key reason for learning language, learning and teaching. In contrast, the second wave overtly focused on peace, cultural and social transformation in language. So as you can see, a very diverse, very intriguing perspective on language education and peace education. Now we have, Anne and I have for several years definitely focused on bringing in guest editors from time to time. At times we've tried to do this once a year if possible. It wasn't always possible to do this every year, but we really tried to increase that way, the diversity of voices that were in the journal and also the conversation, extend the conversation beyond some of the traditional topics that we were otherwise able to cover. So it was a great delight when Dr. Oxford approached us with the idea of also doing a special edition on language and peace education, and bringing to this a very interesting team, a very interesting perspective, a new perspective on language education, which I think could certainly provide some insights, and developed a range of articles that from reflective to analytical, just a great range of reading material and insightful material. So we're glad that Rebecca stuck with us and the team stuck with us despite the COVID experiences of several people, myself included, over the years, and from the change of leadership from me being a senior editor to Anna serving as senior editor, but that we were able to still help bring out this special issue and bring these works to our audience. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Dr. Oxford for the rest of the event.
Can you all hear me? I am very pleased to see everybody here from so many different parts of the world, and I welcome you. And it's my honor to be in this this wonderful group, both the presenters themselves, the journal staff, the visitors viewing from here and beyond. Most of the continents, I think, are probably represented. Why are we doing this special issue? What is this about in the first place? My co-editor for the special issue is Maria Matilde Olivero from Argentina, and she and I wanted especially to present as an underlying theme a multidimensional model of peace. And Lewis, this might in some way get at some of the issues that you were talking about. And let me try to explain how. There are three dimensions in this model, which was first published in a book that I wrote in 2013 called The Language of Peace. So the first dimension is inner peace, the peace inside us, the peace that can pass all understanding if we get there, harmony within ourselves. And that, I think, will be represented very well by some of the papers, especially the first one. It's contemplative. It is inner working with the what happens inside us, then spilling out into our behavior in other forms of peace. The second dimension is social peace. And that is going to be extremely well represented, especially in papers presented by Carol Griffiths and Matt Legg, as we will find out. Social peace includes a range of phenomena, interpersonal, intergroup, as in racial groups, genders, ethnicities, etc., international and intercultural. All of those are aspects of social peace. Then we have the third element, the third dimension of peace in this three-part model, and that is called ecological peace. I think all these three go together. You cannot have peace without the dimension of what goes on inside us. Can't have peace without the interactive part with other people. And in this day and age, we cannot have peace without thinking of the environment. So these are the issues that are going to come up in our various papers that have been published and that we're talking about today. So we welcome you to keep these things in mind. I will go ahead and I will be presenting, I will be introducing the authors of the papers as we go. The first article, I am not the main author of the article, in fact. I am the last author of this first article. Jing Lin, who is my dear friend from the University of Maryland, and her colleagues really did the bulk of this work. And the paper is called fostering a vital life energy field through contemplative practices. And this has to do with contemplative practices within a garden of reflection and remembrance at the University of Maryland. And it's a striking example of how the ecology around us, working with nature, can bring inner peace and interpersonal and social forms of peace. And I'd like to explain that now. Okay, first, Jing Lin is probably the most spiritual person I've ever met. And in fact, she teaches spirituality and contemplative and holistic education. And she has worked with peace studies in China and Africa and all over. Can't say enough about her. Then some of her doctoral students and graduates have worked on the paper as well. And that would be Denise McHugh, who is the manager of the Memorial Chapel and Gardens at the University of Maryland, and Annie Rappaport, Amanda Fiore, both of her graduates in at the University of Maryland. Also, Tom Cullum, who teaches in Canada at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. Okay, what is this paper about? It is about the concept that we are all interconnected in the sense that Thich Nhat Hanh would speak of interbeing. We are tied in with each other. We are part of nature. We are inseparable from all the beings on the earth and well beyond. And you know about some vast spiritual traditions like Hinduism, in which the concept of Thich Nhat Hanh, what he would call, what many of the Eastern traditions would call Qi, also within Islam, within Christianity, Judaism, and virtually all indigenous religions and spiritualities, the concept of linkage and interbeing called by different names. The idea in this paper is that education is not for just passing on information and developing technical skills for living in society. Education is for understanding on a deeper level the interconnectedness of all beings. And education is for having a spirituality that is far deeper than just myself or oneself. What I'd like to do is to tell you about the Garden of Reflection and Remembrance at the University of Maryland, which is the central part of the paper. And it is an example of how education can be seen in a very deep and rich spiritual light, far more than just developing information and knowledge. In 1946, coming out of World War II, some undergraduates at the University of Maryland petitioned the university to create some sort of memorial to peace, not to war, honoring people who gave their lives, but mostly promoting peace for the future. And the university actually listened very carefully and built Memorial Chapel at the University of Maryland in the year, finished it by 1952. At that point, it was Memorial Chapel. There was Garden of Remembrance. There was no labyrinth. Those things came later. The university decided, with the great emphasis from the students, to in 2010 to build the labyrinth for walking meditation. And that was to remember the people who had died in 9/11 in New York, the tragedy, the great tragedy, and to bring about a sense of peace and hope through the walking labyrinth. At the same time, the Garden of Remembrance and Reflection was built as an even deeper way of getting through to a peaceful spiritual reality. The interesting thing about the garden is not only did it have these beautiful trees and bushes and grasses, etc., it also had benches with cubby holes underneath them, and in the cubby holes were journals for people to sit down and write whatever they were feeling and thinking. To me, this is one of the most powerful aspects of the entire arrangement, because people would come through, students, faculty, people in the neighborhood, people from anywhere just passing by could come and sit in the garden, walk the labyrinth, come back and write in the journals. And there have been now, you know, something like 15 different collections of these journal entries by nameless people who have spilled out their hearts for peace, spirituality, and caring. So the university listened. How has this been used? How has this area of remembrance and recollection been used? It's been used through various celebrations. One, the celebration, this is very paradoxical, if you will listen to me and catch on. About 10 or 12 years ago, a young man who was not even from that very campus, but from a different campus of the University of Maryland, was there visiting. And he was shot dead. He was murdered because he was a Black man. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and there was a white supremacist there looking for someone just like him. And so the young man was killed. What happened was almost miraculous in a way. The students and the Memorial Chapel people got a whole group together to celebrate the life of the young man who had died. It did not turn into a free-for-all. It did not turn into a hate spate. It became a celebration of life and joy in support of that young man who died. And it spread peace instead of conflict in a very special way. In addition, okay, that young man's death has been memorialized multiple times because the students have wanted that to happen over the years. And other celebrations for different ceremonies, different parts of the year to honor peace. And I need to check my time. Okay.
Can we move on to the next next speaker, Rebecca? Thank you so much.
Yes. Okay. The next speaker will be this is going to be Sally Ann Kurz, and she is from the University of Alabama at Birmingham. She's presenting a paper that I think will catch your interest. And would you like to tell who the other authors are? I will. I am an author on this paper, and also Joyce Schultz, who is in this audience, is another another author of the paper. And I turn it over to Sally Ann to explain. Notice that there are all three dimensions of peace in this paper.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Rebecca. I was really honored to have co-authored with Rebecca and with Joyce, and now I feel very honored to be able to present our article. The title of our article is From Polycrisis to Peace, and the term polycrisis is it reflects the interconnectedness of the contemporary global challenges, and those together create this multifaceted crisis that we're all facing on a day-to-day, from day to day, and especially now, which we'll talk about a little bit. But the idea of a polycrisis is more calamitous than these individual crises that make up and that create the polycrisis. And that's really the heart of our article, touches on many of those things. And many of them, as I listened to Rebecca talk about Maryland and this beautiful garden, I thought, well, ours doesn't feel quite so inspiring until the end. So there's some things that, because we not only talk about this dimension, the dimensions of peace, but we also talk about the dimensions of crises. And I think that that's something that we're acknowledging in the article. So our discussion is how these polycrises can shift toward peace. And I feel like right now, especially, although I think throughout history, we can see polycrises, but the idea that, you know, right now we have this war raging in Gaza, and this is something that is impacting many people across the world. And then even in the United States, there is a manhunt in Maine after yet another mass shooting, something that we also address in our article. And these mass shootings have plagued the United States for decades now, really, since 1999. So in our article, something that I thought about this morning, this idea of taking sides, I read an article in which a teacher was asked by a student, which team are you on when it came to different groups of people? And the teacher said, I'm on team humanity. And I really loved that, because it made me think that, you know, that's the team I'm on. That's what it means to me to be a peace builder. And I think that when Rebecca brought me into this, and as we collaborated with this, that was the heart of the article, was peace building and understanding the peace building. So she reminded us in her introduction of the multidimensional peace model. And in our article, we talk a lot about that interconnectedness of ecological, social, and inner peace that she described for us a little bit earlier. So I'm going to kind of go past that part of me with the article. But we explored those interwoven aspects really in a lot of detail in the article, thinking about the ecological crises, those living organisms and the physical environments. And we talk about several ecological crises, and then the interpersonal, the social crises, which covers interpersonal, intergroup, intercultural, international. And then obviously that inner crises that Rebecca also addressed in people's hearts and minds and souls. And so the article has three main sections. The first section is a guided journey into the contemporary issues, these three dimensions of crises that we talk about that correspond with the peace model and the three dimensions of peace. And the idea in the article is that we want to acknowledge the dynamics of the crises so that we can channel our energy into overcoming. So while we do have many despairing details about the suffering and the elements in these three crises. In our second section, we present what I think are very diverse ways to tune down what we call the cacophony of crisis and tuning up the harmony of peace. So acknowledging that these crises exist, and then also acknowledging that we have the agency to tune that up into harmony. And in the third section, we offer what I think are very practical suggestions and hope for the future. And I think what makes our suggestions so practical is that they cover, as Rebecca did in the introduction, a wide range of spiritual beliefs. So we're not just addressing Christianity or Hinduism or Buddhism, or we're talking about many things that can be done with spirituality, not just religion, and many ways of being spiritual or religious. Much like she discussed with the garden, we're giving examples from lots of different walks of life that exemplify how we can shift from this kind of what I would call a palpable, ever-present crises, that polycrisis that just drowns or suffocates so many human beings, so that we're able to move toward what seems like unattainable peace. But if we look at the things that we can do, we can realize that we do have that agency. Each human being has the agency to react to this polycrisis and to channel the suffering into an overcoming and to shift into that peace. And so we understand and we address in the article, we cannot mend a broken world. We can't recreate a world without tragedy, but we can seek the peace and meaning despite suffering. You know, suffering is common to all of us. If we think of it, we could think of it as a uniter rather than a divider, because it's one common thing to all humanity. And in the article, we talk about a peace-building toolbox. We talk about caring, capabilities, and creativity, and all of the different elements in those things that we can use to transcend tragedy and to promote peace. Things like, you know, she talked about the garden, walking in the world and acknowledging the emotions, the good emotions and the bad emotions, right? Sitting in those strong emotions that we have and channeling them for our well-being. And this might be in a meditation, in connecting with others, and in connecting with our inner self. But the idea is that we use this tragedy and suffering to grow and to give ourselves and others grace while we use those gifts that can heal ourselves and maybe not mend, but can heal the broken world that we live in. And Rebecca mentions Thich Nhat Hanh, and I wanted to just end with two quotes from activists. One of them is from Thich Nhat Hanh, and it is, "Each moment is a chance for us to make peace with the world, to make peace possible for the world, and to make happiness possible for the world." And the other comes from Hafsat Abiola, a Nigerian human rights activist. And they say, "Peace comes from being able to contribute the best that we have and all that we are toward creating a world that supports everyone, but is also securing the space for others to contribute the best that they have and all that they are." Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Sally Ann. I would like to present now my great friend, Carol Griffiths. And I've known her for years from the language education field. She has lived and worked, as a child, she was born in England, family moved to New Zealand. She has taught in North Korea, China, Turkey, England, now in North Cyprus, and I'm sure there are other places. Carol is focusing on social peace, multiple aspects of social peace, and her paper is called Once We're Enemies, the Importance of Interpersonal, Intercultural, and International Relationships in the Search for Peace. Carol?
Right, okay. Thanks for that, Rebecca. Am I online? Am I?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Okay. I can see you. I guess that's okay. Thank you for the introduction, yes. Okay, well, people. As Rebecca has just said, I was actually born in England. I've lived most of my life at the other end of the world, or almost exactly at the other end of the world, other end. And so maybe the background, having been born in England, it gives some background to my own attitudes, perhaps towards peace, or more precisely, in a way, the lack of peace. Because I mean, my grandfather lived through both, lived and worked in both world wars. He was an ambulance driver in France during the First World War, and he drove buses in London right through the Second World War. My father, in the Second World War, he worked at the Woolwich Arsenal. I don't know whether any of you know it. Perhaps you, Liz, would know the Woolwich. So this was sort of very much part of, this was the family culture. And I'm not sure that's entirely a good thing, but that's the way it was. Because, as they got together, Dad and Granddad particularly, would talk about the war and things that happened and so on. Anyway, I myself grew up and I became a teacher, and I taught for most of my life in New Zealand, in fact. But then I decided I wanted to move overseas and to have a bit more experience. And so I've been, as Rebecca has already said, to a lot of places. They've been wonderful. They've been very different. But I think perhaps a similarity that I can't help reflecting on is that actually they have all been, in one way or another, been shaped actually by war. I'm currently working in the Turkish Republic of North Cyprus, it's called. That's the official title. So this is Cyprus. And I imagine most of you will have some awareness. Cyprus itself is actually a divided island. It's, it's just the island, but it's right down the middle, but the north is separated from the south. It's very difficult. You have to go through checkpoints to get to the other side from where I am. I'm on the Turkish side, just to clarify that. But of course, I worked in Turkey itself before I was here. Turkey, of course, this is where, Gallipoli happened. And that's especially important for New Zealanders, the Anzacs. Thousands of young New Zealanders. It made a huge hole in an entire generation of young men. And so this war, but of course it also made a very big hole in a generation of young Turks as well. Gallipoli, I don't know how many of you might have been there, but actually it's an extremely sad place. But I think it's one of the most memorable things about going to Gallipoli for myself was coming to this memorial. Can I read it to you? I'm keeping an eye on the time, but yes, it's attributed to Atatürk and Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. These heroes that shed their blood and lost their lives. You are now lying in the soil of a friendly country. Therefore, rest in peace. There is no difference between the Johnnies and the Mehmets to us, where they lie side by side in this country of ours. You, the mothers who sent their sons from faraway countries, wipe away your tears. Your sons are now lying, I can't read it without even now, I don't know how many times, lying at our bosom and are in peace. After having lost their lives on this land, they have become our sons as well. And as I said, even now I have done it many times, but I can't read it or even think about it without emotion. The sad thing is, of course, How peaceful is it? But I'll go into that in a minute. Another place where I was, which is also incredibly shaped by war, is, of course, I was in North Korea. And I mean North Korea, not. I've also been to South Korea, but I've never taught there. But anyway, I had the opportunity to go to North Korea. And people say, what was it like? Well, I obviously, it's hard to even begin to describe it. It's very different. It's very interesting. I enjoyed my time there in a way. It wasn't easy, but it was interesting. But of course, there was a point where I was taken down to the demilitarized zone. And you get to the demilitarized zone from the north, going across the, all of the minefields, but there's a sort of a causeway and barbed wire, razor wire lined with razor wire. And you get to these, the huts. These huts were made famous, that's the word, by Donald Trump, met Kim Jong-un there. And they were stepping over this, it's 6 inches high. That's all it is. Honestly, you can step over it, no trouble. But it's the dividing line between the two Koreas. Of course, it was not the Koreans who put that there. It was, the Russians coming down from the north, the Americans coming up from the south. So they slapped the line across the 38th parallel. It divided families and land, and they've never seen each other ever since. It's still the case. And Donald Trump was going to issue an era of peace, wasn't he? We're still waiting. We're still waiting. Another one was China. Well, of course, China has had wars, forever. The Great Wall of China, which is supposed to be the only man-made object you could see from space, and I don't quite know how true that is. But I mean, that was to stop people coming down from the north. Genghis Khan and those guys. But of course, also, I mean, it wasn't only from the north that China was getting invaded. There was also coming in from the south. In particular, one that I saw at one stage was the Anglo-French. I mean, in other words, the British and the French, the Europeans, us.
Carol,
Summer Palace. Yeah?
I'm sorry. We have to move into your peace part because we don't want to cut out the peace part.
All right, okay. Well, how it had to peace. All right. So, yes, you want me to talk about peace. Yes, all right. Well, I'll skip the rest of China then. Although,
I'm sorry.
No, you're fine, Rebecca. I can take the point. At the same time, I'm not sure we can talk about peace, but... and how is my time?
We're coming into match.
Where I am right now, we have sorry, I'm gonna get onto this again, Rebecca. We have two very nasty wars. I mean, within an hour in either direction. Peace, it's a long way off. And what can we do about this? Well, I guess we can only hope that things like the Canadian Journal of Peace and Conflict may contribute to it. But I don't know. I'm not sure. And I'm sorry, Rebecca. I know that probably isn't what you want me to say. But what are we going to actually do about this? We can talk, we can write. But these other actions go on, and frankly, they show no sign of slowing down or changing. And but let's hope so. Maybe at least our articles will contribute, and maybe help to change people's attitudes. And maybe, let's hope so. Okay.
Thank you, Carol. I think we need to underscore the fact that her title, the title of the paper is Once We're Enemies. That gives us a thread of hope that yes. perhaps they were enemies and there might be change, at least in hearts and minds of some people. And we hope that those people will have some sway. So yes. thank you, Carol.
Okay. Well, you're very welcome.
Yes. I know we can hope. Our next presenter is Matt Legg, and he is a wonderful person. I was in his class about a book that he wrote called Are We Done Fighting? And he is a program coordinator at the Canadian Friends Service Committee and has done peace research in various parts of the world. So I will leave it to Matt, and he's going to talk about his article, What Peace and Conflict Studies Can Offer to Social Change Movements. So Matt.
Thanks, Rebecca. So I work for Canadian Friends Service Committee, which is the social justice agency of Quakers in Canada, the Religious Society of Friends. And I'm not an academic and I don't conduct original research, but I am a practitioner and I work with a lot of different peace groups. And so basically, I'm just somebody who's curious and who believes from the many stories I've heard that conflict transformation is usually possible and in often surprising and inspiring ways. So between 2012 and 2019, in my time here at CFSC, I had the opportunity to learn a great deal from many experts on peace and conflict issues. I did a lot of reading and summarizing research findings from different fields. And my big question was always, what can I learn from this that I can actually apply to conflict transformation? So it's always with a very practical lens. And that learning culminated in, as Rebecca said, my 2019 book, Are We Done Fighting? Building Understanding in a World of Hate and Division. Over the years, I became more aware of the phenomenon that gets called culture wars. And so as I looked into biases that contribute to the other side's bad behavior, so I was asking these questions of why did they think this and why do they behave this way, I came to the uncomfortable realization that I do a lot of the same things. Things like only looking for information that seems to confirm that the world is how I want it to be. Things like sometimes reading opponents in less than generous ways. Things like imputing ill intent. So I came to realize that I was in a particular bubble that fed me only one narrow perspective. And it made the world seem a lot more clear-cut and a lot less messy than it actually is. So since the book came out in 2019, I was given a blog by Psychology Today, and I've continued to explore these themes. I blog on topics like destructive so-called culture wars and affective polarization. That is where we don't just split into different camps that believe different things, but where we come to feel negatively about the other side as people. So my work today is still about looking to what experts in various fields would recommend to transform destructive conflicts. And I'm also really interested in positive examples and trying to lift those stories up, because I think very often we ignore them and we focus on the negative. So I was really excited for this opportunity to contribute to this issue of peace research, and I wanted to explore those same topics of social peace. And so, why is it that so many of us feel like we're in the midst of this culture war today where we have to destroy the other side as in a real war? I looked at several of the drivers in the article. I looked at thorny issues of what's true and how different sides each claim to be innocent victims. And I made a few recommendations. But mainly, I've come to believe that active nonviolence is an incredibly powerful and underappreciated set of techniques or a lifestyle or a faith commitment, depending on how you want to approach it. Different camps in the culture wars don't seem to be too aware of active nonviolence or of the best practices for persuasion or negotiation or seeking justice. So in many cases, actors on different sides each hold an overly simplistic zero-sum framing of the issue. And they share a misplaced faith in the power of crushing an opponent to get their way. This is simply out of step with the state of knowledge in many relevant fields, as I explained in the paper. So many brave and inspiring figures have understood that peace means positive peace. It means peace grounded in justice and mutuality. And that peace can best be won using peaceful means, not ones that humiliate, dehumanize, or seek to destroy an opponent, as happens in a war. So knowledge from highly relevant fields of study, such as peace and conflict studies, but also social psychology, neuroscience, network science, this knowledge seems to be largely unknown to the most influential actors in the culture wars. And these folks engage in ways that are often less than optimal for achieving their own goals, and they're incredibly detrimental to society more generally. So I draw out a few lessons from those relevant fields of study that are often ignored. And I briefly touch on how these can be incorporated by anyone engaging in conflicts on contentious issues from veganism to abortion. Specifically, I highlight a framework for classifying four types of nonviolent action: interest-based, rights-based, power-based, and compassion-based. And that last one is the easiest to ignore, I think, in these contentious debates. So I argue that actors can benefit from learning that all four types of actions exist. And that's because a strategy that can use a mix of those actions is most likely to be successful. I also encourage any professors who are reading the paper to teach about active nonviolence to help broaden the base of people who are aware that it exists and to know what tools are out there for social change. So, of course, there are no guarantees in social change work, right? We're talking about complex adaptive systems with countless factors at play, and different actors are each seeking to influence these issues in so many ways. So there's no linear path to success. There's no guarantee that nonviolent direct action will work. Still, it's more likely to succeed than some popular approaches to seeking social change today. And when nonviolent direct action fails, it does so with far less cost to all of us. So that's what I argued in the paper. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm so glad to hear the real people talking out loud, and the papers are just as courageous and interesting as these folks. And Anna,
thank you again, Rebecca, and all of the contributors for. Well, I guess as Carol is saying, for keeping the hope alive and by contributing your knowledge and your passion and your research. And I think it's always important, especially important right now, to have that information on constructive conflict, as Lou says, and that can help us make our way through difficult times. So thank you everyone for joining the Peace Research Launch, and next year I'm sure we'll launch another one with our guest editor on racism and refugee policies. So have a good weekend, and thank you so much.
One more thing.
Yes.
Can you just tell people how they can access the journal?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Yes, you can access it on our website. We have mostly library subscriptions, so you can also access it through EBSCOhost and JSTOR. If you or your library don't have a subscription or an individual subscription, but of course we're happy for subscriptions. Yeah, so it's you can go to the Peace Research website. Thanks for that plug, Rebecca.
Yeah. And if anybody would like to speak to any of the authors or to me or to Matilde, who couldn't be here, my email about the special issue or anything else is RebeccaOxford@gmail.com. That's RebeccaOxford@gmail.com. If you want to know more about this particular special issue, or go to the website for the journal. Okay. And thank you. Thank you so much for the privilege. Anna, Neil.
It's been great, Rebecca. Thank you. And I just put your email in the chat, and Frida put the website for Peace Research in the chat as well. Thank you. Great to meet all of you. And hopefully we'll see you again next year.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anna.